Hello, this is Ari Pincus with the American Communities Project. Today I'm speaking with Sarah Ashley Andrews, who founded and runs the nonprofit organization Dare to Hope, based in Philadelphia. Dare to Hope's mission is to conquer suicide in youth and young adults. Welcome, Sarah Ashley, and thanks for taking time to talk with me today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I want to start by asking you when and why you came to do this important work.
Okay, so back in 2012, I lost a friend to suicide. He died by suicide. We were 25 years old, and kind of took us all by surprise. We didn't know, like, that he was even suffering, like, from any kind of mental illness or suffering with suicidal thoughts. So from that loss, I wanted to create something where I could educate people. Like, I just wanted to make people aware of what was going on with people's mental health, especially in the Black community.
Okay. And can you tell us how your education and experience have prepared you and guides you in your work today?
So it's funny because when I first went to college, I was a mass comm major. So I wasn't even thinking about, like, mental health or anything like that. Once he passed and I kind of changed my focus to more so human services, I got my undergrad degree in biblical studies and human services. And then after getting my undergrad degree, I realized that I wanted to help people in a larger capacity. So I went back to get my master's in counseling psychology. And now I just passed my national counseling examination and am on track to get my license to be a licensed psychotherapist. So it really has shaped my work, and it just allows me to be more knowledgeable. When I first started Dare to Hope, I would bring my friend who had her master's in counseling already. I would bring her with me just as, you know, backup, but now it just has caused me to be more knowledgeable and to be able to help people in a greater capacity.
Wow, that's a really inspiring story, and congratulations on moving forward in your career.
Thank you.
Now, could you describe your organization's approach and what makes it unique?
So what makes it unique is that I can be very relatable. And I used to, I'm small. You never met me in person, but I'm small. I'm 5'1". I'm like 108 pounds, right? So I can relate. When we go into schools, it's a relatable factor, right? A lot of schools that we go to are in the urban community. I grew up in North Philadelphia, which is an urban neighborhood in Philadelphia. So it just makes us relatable. And my approach is to be as real as I can, to be as transparent as I can with the students, with the teachers, with the staff, because that's how we have real conversations, right? When we make it a safe place to have unrestricted conversations, and when I'm transparent enough about my stuff, the stuff that I suffered with, the depression that I went through, it makes it easier for people to open up and share what they've been going through.
Now, have you changed what you do for clients since you started, and particularly amid the pandemic?
Of course. So when prior to COVID and the stay-at-home orders, we would actually go into schools, right? We had the opportunity to actually get face-to-face with the students, have assemblies, have our workshops that would last for 6 weeks. So we got to really get to know the students that we worked with. When the pandemic hit, of course, all that stopped because school went virtual, but then we had to kind of redirect our program, right? How can we still reach these children and not being able to actually see them? So we created a Safe Saturdays program where we go out, but we host a virtual platform on Saturdays called Safe Saturdays, where kids can log in and get the same 6 week program that they would get in their school virtually on Saturdays. So that's one thing that we did. And even in that, like, I also, during the pandemic, created a podcast where each week I can now talk about mental wellness. So that's something else that I pivoted on and created another outlet for us to be able to get the word out and the message out about mental wellness.
Wow, that sounds very resourceful. What have you witnessed in the ways that people of different ages respond to your approach?
So the older the audience, the harder it is to kind of break the stigma. You know, younger kids will always talk. They're always willing to talk, especially when, you know, you build the trust factor with them. But the older we get, there's more of a fight, more of a resistance to what we talk about. a lot of what we talk about is based on like total mental wellness, and that's, you know, healthy eating, exercising, but then a bigger component of that is therapy. And, you know, in within the Black community, it's still kind of shunned upon and like looked down on. So there's a bigger fight the older I get with the audience. We can kind of convince people to live mentally well in their teens and in their, you know, their adolescent ages. But when they get older, it's kind of like their resistance is still there.
Now, there's long been a stigma around suicide, including in the Black community. What's behind the stigma, and how do you see the community moving beyond it and your role in that moving process?
There's so many factors that are behind it, right? One of the factors that I have been seeing more commonly is the religious risk factor, right? And people don't always look at religion as a risk factor, but you got to realize that, you know, a lot of times people feel like they are forsaking their higher power by going to seek help, right, for their mental wellness. Or people feel like pray about it and leave it alone. Or there is a stigma tied to it from religious leaders that are telling people, listen, like, you don't need it. Like, therapy is a fad, or therapy is, you know, something that everybody's on. But as long as you have Jesus, or as long as you pray to God, you'll be okay. So that's one of the more common stigmas or risk factors that I'm seeing now. There's also what goes on in the house stays in the house, right? Like, nobody else should know your problems. We'll be able to figure it out in-house versus bringing somebody else in here to tell me about my issues. I think another part that plays in it, especially when I see Black families as clients, is that they're thinking that therapy is this big thing that it's not, right? They always see it on TV. It's real dramatic on TV, but once they come into my office or the office space that I occupy, then it's like, oh, this wasn't what I thought it was going to be. You know what I mean? So I think there is a stigma from what we have watched in the movies and on TV shows that kind of cause people to be a little leery about it. And then also, like, another major one is that there aren't a lot of culturally competent therapists out there, right? So if I'm Black, then do I trust to sit in front of a white therapist? Will a white therapist be able to relate to my issues and what really understand what I'm going through? So that's a whole nother issue, too.
I see. So that goes back to what you were saying about being relatable.
Right.
It's very clear. Could you talk about how you've become a trusted resource in Philadelphia?
I think being consistent, right? I think the consistency. I think when people see the work that we've done, we've been consistent over the years, right? So that if somebody was to check the records and be like, well, why would I trust her? And they can look back on it and why. I think my program was for this amount of years. I've, you know, went back to school to get my degrees and so I can know what I'm really talking about, right? Because a lot of people can make a video about mental wellness and self-care and coping skills, but if I take you out in the deep end, can I bring you back to shore, right? Do I have the tools to bring you back to shore? And I think that's what separates me from a lot of people, is that now I went back and got the education to back up the work I've been doing. So I was doing the work, got the education, and now we're doing the greater work. And I think just being consistent is the major key.
That's understandable. What response have you received from the community as a whole?
It's been mostly positive. People don't want to have the hard conversations, so they'll bring you in to have the hard conversations, right? And they trust me enough to have the hard conversations and to leave the people with something that's going to empower them, not leave them feeling down after a program or after an assembly or after a workshop, right? So the response has been, well, every time we go somewhere, you know, they say that they weren't expecting to get what they got, right? So I think the response is, well, and I think it's mostly because a lot of times people don't want to have these hard conversations. So who can I bring in to have these hard conversations with my youth, with my church, with my mosque, my masjid? Who can I come in to have these conversations?
And have you received pushback from folks in the community?
I can tell you one story of one time I was doing a presentation at a school within a church. And there was pushback that day because we just didn't agree on suicide, right? You know, it was an issue with that. But other than that, like, I haven't gotten any pushback because, again, either you believe in it or not even believe in it. Either you know that it's a problem and know that it's a problem that can be solved and should be solved, or you just choose to ignore it. So if nobody really has pushed back on me about the work we've done, you know, it's about what you believe in. And I think that's where the religious part comes in at. But other than that, like, no, nobody has pushed back, because I think people know, I think deep down inside people know that it's a needed resource. And, you know, it's a lot of other resources out there. So you don't have to necessarily choose there or hope, but, you know, nobody's pushed back on it.
Well, when you say pushback against suicide, what do you mean by that?
So I'll just tell you what happened. We were talking about suicide, and this lady, like, kind of interrupted the presentation and was like, "Oh, well, you're going to hell if you commit suicide. So just letting all you kids know right now, you're going to hell." And I'm a licensed minister too, and I'm, you know, liberal. And so I had to tell her, like, you know, no, like, me and her, so me and her had a little back and forth conversation about that. But literally, other than that one time that I can remember, nobody has pushed back on what I've been teaching or what's been taught or what information has come through Dare to Hope.
Okay. Well, thank you for explaining that. I'm sure that was a difficult day. Now, what major changes have you seen in how the topic of suicide is viewed in the U.S. and Philadelphia in particular, and how suicidal thoughts are treated?
Can you repeat the first part for one more time? I'm sorry.
Sure. What major changes have you seen in how the topic of suicide is viewed in the U.S. and Philadelphia in particular?
Okay. So when I first started Dare to Hope, nobody was really talking about suicide, right? It was kind of still hush-hush. I remember getting calls to be invited to schools, and the principals would be whispering, like, "Can you come talk to my kids about suicide?" And I'm like, "Why are you whispering about it? Like, you know, why are we scared to talk about suicide out loud up front?" And it bothered me, because so many people were losing their lives or losing the battle to mental illness, right? So I think in the beginning, and I've been doing Dare to Hope now for almost 10 years, so I've seen the transition of people openly now talking about their mental wellness, talking about why it's important to take care of your mind the way you take care of your body. So I think that the stigma has kind of been, I don't want to say disappearing, but easing up a little bit. Again, I think the harder work is with the older adults. The millennials get it, right? We get it. The Gen, I guess, these, whoever's coming after us, they get it, right? But I think the issue is still on those traditional older adults who don't really accept the fact that they may have something going on in their minds that needs to be checked out. But I'm telling you, like, it's been a shift. It definitely has been a shift in the right direction as far as people caring about themselves, and that includes their mental health too.
That's very good to hear. Speaking of differences, have you noticed any differences in attitudes about suicide in Philadelphia versus the surrounding suburbs?
I think it's always been accepted in the suburbs, right? I think it's always been something that has been put on the forefront in the suburbs. I think for the urbanized area, like, you know, the North Phillies, the South Phillies, I think that it hasn't been touched on enough yet. I think that we're headed in the right direction, but I think that it's always been normalized in the suburbs. I mean, we can just be honest, within white families and with white people, I think it's always been normalized. Like, therapy is something that just happened, right? Whereas in black families, it's like, therapy, you know, we don't do that. You know what I mean? So I think that it was always normalized in the suburbs, or at least more normalized in the suburbs than it was in Philadelphia.
Okay. And do you see distinctions between blacks with college degrees and blacks without college degrees in the way that they see the issue?
No, I don't. Honestly, I don't. I don't. I think that across the board, again, like I said, millennials get it. Okay. And I don't think a college degree, I don't think the degree makes the difference. I know people with degrees and people without them. And it's still our mental health is very important now. Very important.
So it's generational, not educational.
Yeah, I think it's generational. Yeah, that's the perfect way to say it. I think it's generational, not educational.
Great. Thanks for clarifying. Now, what discussions come up, and what are you learning when you talk with colleagues and friends in other cities?
That it's the same stuff that we deal with here is what people are dealing with other places. Okay. It is not really a difference. Even when you look at the trauma from the crime, it's like, it's crime happening in Philly, but it's crime happening in Chicago. It's crime happening in Baltimore. It's crime happening in Florida. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So the same stuff that our kids are facing is really the same, right? It's the same across the board. And then just coming up with different ways and different approaches to solving it, right? Like, I'm a solution-focused therapist. So, like, I'm a person that's, like, going to try to, you know, get with the cognitive behavior thinking, like, you know, let's get with your mind and let's change your behavior, but also, like, solution-focused. So, like, how can we fix this? And I think that, you know, when I talk to my colleagues in other areas, it's, like, the same approach. Like, how do we get to the bottom of what is bothering or plaguing our kids in urban communities?
Can you give an example of an occasion that you've come together with folks in other cities and something that you've talked about and tried to find a solution to?
Oh, yeah. So we do many think tanks and we get together and discuss cases and we discuss the more so try to get to the root, right? So we look at patterns, and even sometimes we pull out the genograms and look at patterns of families and, like, how do we then, if we see that this is a pattern, how do we then prevent stuff from happening, right? If I know this family has generations of people not graduating high school or people not being able to get into the workforce and get good paying jobs, how do we then prevent it, right? If this new baby's coming, at what age do we stop and prevent this? Like, where do we intervene in this family to prevent this person from going down that same path that the last two generations have gone down? So I think that's the work I love to do when we look at patterns and try to figure out how do we stop it from happening again.
Wow.
And coming up with plans like that. That's what I like the most about, you know, when we get all together and plan.
Wow, that's so interesting. Thank you for sharing that. Now, what are your biggest challenges now and on the horizon?
Money, right? It costs money to help people. We can't do it for free. So I think just finding the funding is always, you know, our biggest goal because we need the money to continue to work.
Okay.
So I think that's what, you know, that's what it is. And I again, like I said, the stigma is breaking, and, you know, people are investing more money into mental health and looking at mental health as an issue. I remember a couple years ago, I applied for a grant from the city to bring mental health therapist to the urban communities, and I didn't get the grant, right? But I know this year, if I put it in, because people have been focusing on mental health, because you know, cases like Walter Wallace has happened and it had made public, you know, like national news, now people's focus is on mental wellness and mental health. So I think that, you know, again, with the years that pass, the shift changes and people put more focus into their mental health and understand that if we get people's mental health regulated, a lot of things will change in the city.
Yeah, that's understandable. Where have you seen the greatest signs of hope in your work?
When I see a kid, and again, we work at some of the what some would call the worst schools in the city, right? We go to schools where kids have been kicked out of the public school system and now are in an alternative school. But when I see a kid come in the beginning of the 6 weeks, all over the place, and then by week two or week three, they're working through whatever project we're working on that particular week, and their attitude is starting to shift, they're processing their emotions out better, they're communicating better, they're behaving better. That's the highlight for me. Like, that's when we can see the work being done. And even with my clients, when I see, you know, them doing their homework and coming back a month from the time we started session and just are, like, I don't want to say total different people, but I can see the progress. That's what makes me want to continue my work, because I know that what we're teaching is changing lives.
That is really inspiring. Thank you for sharing that. And
no problem.
Thank you so much for this wonderful conversation.
No, thank you for contacting me and allowing me to talk about the work we do.
Oh, absolutely. I've been speaking with Sarah Ashley Andrews of Dare to Hope. Thank you so much, Sarah Ashley.
Thank you.